Hello and welcome to the AIPT Comics Podcast, episode 225. Oh my god, it's like a milestone number.
Wow.
And we're not even celebrating.
No.
We do have a new feature image for the show that I've been holding on to for a special guest that we're trying to line up. We're not going to say their name because we don't want to spoil it or jinx it. So,
ladies and gentlemen, Megatron.
Hello, I'm here to kill Optimus Prime.
Optimus Prime, though. I would like to have Optimus Prime on the show.
Yeah. Have you seen... I'm going to start the show off a little blue. Have you seen that... That montage, someone is like... put together all the clips of Optimus Prime saying some variation of I'm coming or let them come from the Transformers movies.
No, that's funny.
He says it twice in the new trailer alone. It's so wild. The guy...
Interesting.
For a robot...
There's a lore there.
Loves to come.
Well, they have one that pees, so, I mean, why not,
right? Right.
Bodily fluid Transformers.
And listeners, thank you all for coming today.
Yes, thank you so much. We wouldn't do it without you. Later in the show, Tom King, Phil Hester joined the show to talk Gotham Year One. Mm-hmm. This was an interview that took place in March, so there's a little, like, oh, I can't wait for the last issue conversation.
Sure.
But the FOC for the trade paperback is June 11th if you're a comics retailer, so I think this is good timing for the interview. It's a really good interview. If you like noir, we get really deep into that.
Yeah.
We talk a little bit about Wonder Woman as well. Tom's taking over Wonder Woman in a couple months from now, so some tidbits there. But Gotham Year One, if you haven't checked it out, is a really cool book. Phil Hester kills it on art.
One of your favorite books of the year, I think it's safe to say.
Yeah, I think so. You know, it's that time again where we have to do best books of the year so far.
I know, we're getting close,
we're
right?
We're 6 months in, I think. Yeah,
so maybe that'll crazy.
Come up soon.
Yeah.
And yeah, I think it would be on there. I mean, I'm a huge noir head.
Same.
As they call
oh,
us.
For sure. They do say that. Yeah.
It's actually on my license in Massachusetts. You have to say one of your fandoms.
Well, yeah, legally, if someone asks you if you're a noir head, you have to say yes.
That's true. It's sort of like if you're a cop.
If you're undercover.
This is entrapment. Are you a noir head? No, I only like to talk about detective noirs.
Why are we watching The Third Man right now?
My God, they're on to me.
You said this was a pizza party.
This here is Lenore Zan, a.k.a. Rogue.
It's Cal Dodd here, voice of Wolverine from X-Men, the animated series, Bub. Join me at The Uncanny Experience. The ultimate destination for X-Men fans just like you.
You will become a mutant student at Xavier's.
And be able to explore the school campus, shop the vendor hall, and meet the creators and stars of the X-Men universe.
Get your tickets now, sugar, at theuncannyexperience.com.
Dude, I'm in a really good mood because I saw Across the Spider-Verse last night.
Yes. Oh, it's fresh in your mind.
It's still, it's right there. You saw it Thursday, yeah?
I saw it Thursday, yep, and, 6 p.m.
And man, I gotta say, like, it's, I'm still digesting it. I think I'm, you know, maybe once the whole trilogy shakes out, I'll feel differently. I think I still give the edge to the first one a little bit, but, like, these are, hands down, I mean, these are the best comic book movies we've ever gotten. Like, the most comic book movies we've ever gotten.
Totally, yeah. And it's so cool to see people like fall in love with Spider-Punk when actually owning some Justin Mason Spider-Punk art.
Yeah.
And now people are falling in love with the character.
It's so exciting and so fun. We were talking about this when we were texting after the movie, and this is a film that, like, these movies respect the creators that brought these different variations to life as well. Like, it was such a thrill seeing, you know, artists' names on the big screen whenever they do one of their little chapter breaks. And I'm like, holy shit, like, literally a Spider-Man 2099 cover plops onto the screen. Rick Leonardi's name is, like, right up in huge letters. It's so fucking cool to see.
And the fact that they introduce each character with a stack of comic books.
Mm-hmm.
Because they're literally saying, look, these are from
this is
a
where
thing
this comes
that you
from.
Can go buy.
These are our modern myths. Come on, guys.
So it's honoring the craft while making its own, you know, paving the way for its own style and everything. Like, it's just amazing. I think people keep, and you said this off air a minute ago, like, there's so much to take in visually.
Yeah.
You kind of have to watch it again.
New every time. And then just with all the changing animation styles, some of which are coexisting within one frame at the same time.
Yeah.
It's just so much to take in, so much kinetic energy with every single second of the movie. I adored it. And it's, you know, I think it's also it continues the really important messages of the first movie of, you know, coming to love yourself and being able to be authentic with your family. I think, I just think it's, yeah, it's, it continues to be the best and most important comic book series, I think, on the big screen.
Yeah, it's impressive how they're nailing the characters, they're nailing the messaging and the visual on top of, like, everything's firing on all cylinders. Yep. And we get another one in 6 months, I think?
Yeah, in March, so a little
That's
bit over.
That's crazy.
Can't wait.
That's crazy. I mean, obviously the other one's probably almost done at this point.
Right.
They did have, what was it, like 6 years since the last one?
Almost five years. I couldn't believe, just like, there were several times during the movie I just wanted to pinch myself because I'm like, I'm watching a movie with Hobie Brown and Miguel O'Hara as primary characters. Like, that's crazy.
Who was it? I think it was Saladin Ahmed. He was tweeting on Friday when he goes to conventions, the younger audience thinks Miles is the main Spider-Man and Peter's the old man, which is so fascinating to me.
I mean, I really do believe that we are going to reach a point where, yeah, we don't really even think about the original Spider-Man. These are Spider-Man. You know?
Right, right.
I mean, we're already kind of moving in that direction with the new video game that's coming out later this year with where you can swap between the two characters interchangeably, which I think is incredible.
Crazy.
I mean, Miles is the guy starring in a major crossover in the comics right now, not Peter.
You know? Right.
So
right, yeah.
I don't know. It's I mean, and of course, you know, some of that is just pure synergy, baby. But
true. I was thinking that too. Yeah.
But even outside of that, I think we've moved beyond the need to delineate them as, you know, a legacy. You know, Miles being a legacy character. I think Miles Morales is Spider-Man, and that fucking rules. Peter Parker also is Spider-Man, and that fucking rules.
Like, right. You know, it's funny, when I write reviews, I always think, like, do you call, you know, Ghost Spider, Spider-Man, or a Spider-Man?
Oh,
and I always think, oh, that's not right, because it's Spider-Man. That's a gender. But then in the movie, in this movie we just saw, there's a female character that goes, we're all Spider-Man. And I was like, oh, so I can use it that way.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's if you haven't seen it, go see it. It's
a
really a work of art, and even if you don't like, you know, superhero movies, you're going to appreciate the visual aesthetic. It's mind-boggling how they pulled this thing off. It's crazy.
I mean, we're already seeing movies like the upcoming Ninja Turtles film, like sort of going for this kind of, you know, pop art aesthetic, and I think I really do believe, you know, in even in just like 5 years' time, we're going to look at the Spider-Verse movies as a new, like, benchmark. Like, this is where animation shifted again as a medium.
Right.
And I some of that is, I don't think that's just recency bias. I think it really is. It is going to prove to be that important to the history of this medium.
Meanwhile, the new Pixar movie is coming out and the buzz is very bad. And, like, that movie looks like every other Pixar movie in the last 10 years.
You're talking about Elemental?
Yeah.
Inside Out 2?
yeah.
Electric Boogaloo?
Yeah, I'm not excited for that. And to your point, though, like, the visual style not really changing. Obviously, they're, you know, we all know Pixar, every movie they're trying to do something different or advance the technology, which they do, and it's amazing that they do. But this one in particular, I'm like, it kind of looks like the other one.
Sure.
But yeah, and whereas this one is going for it, like, there's nothing else like it.
No. Yeah, there were multiple times during the movie where I, like, realized, oh, I haven't, like, taken in a breath in, like, 10 or 15 seconds. Like,
that's why they had oxygen drop from the ceiling.
That's right. Yeah, they were like, oh, the helicopter scene's coming up here. Let's drop some oxygen masks.
That's funny. You know what else is nothing like anything else?
The news?
This podcast.
Yeah.
Because every episode is completely different.
Because
we talk about the biggest news of the week. We review our favorite comics out this week. And more. This week had some crazy news that I say crazy because the buzz was insane. Like, there was, I think, like 100,000 views on our tweets for IDW announcing new DC titles in their artist editions, including Batman Year One and Neil Adams's DC Classics.
Yeah. And these, this is the first time they've done DC, right? They've done, yeah, they've done Marvel previously.
Mm-hmm. They've done a lot of Marvel. It's like Jim Lee had one for X-Men, that's right, for instance. Mm-hmm. Walt Simonson has a couple out, actually. And here, though, yeah, they're dipping their toes into the DC. So if, mm-hmm, if you're not familiar, artist editions are basically they're the size of which the artist was drawing. Because mm-hmm, the paper they draw on is almost, I'd say, 25% bigger than the actual comic. No, maybe more, 50% bigger.
Yeah, maybe.
They're quite large. They're in these like hardcover cases, and you open them up, and so yeah, you get the full effect of what the artist was going, mm-hmm, for. That means pencils, so before ink and color.
Yeah.
And for, you know, Batman Year One, which is a classic, Mitch Gerads apparently has been saying, why don't we get an artist edition of Batman Year One? And when this news went up, someone was like, oh my God, Mitch Gerads wished this into existence.
He said something like, I think he tweeted literally like 3 nights ago, every single night I pray to David Mazzucchelli. Like,
yes, yes. And and IDW probably sensed the excitement for that, because mm-hmm, they actually showed two pages from the OG, and yeah, actually there's like stains on it even. So like they legit got the pages,
yeah,
and then scanned them in like high def. So we're getting like practically what was on the page in this book.
I am so excited for that, and I'm possibly even more excited for the Neil Adams edition. Like the, having these classic Green Arrow and Batman stories in this, mm-hmm, format is just, it's a dream come true.
Yeah, and like any artist even, I mean, just to see what it looks like before, mm-hmm, the inks and colors come in is, it's like, actually I was thinking about this recently, like Dan Mora, like, mm-hmm, Dan Mora works so fast, and he's only doing pencils, right?
Right, yeah.
And that, and what we saw his pencils recently in that Brave and the Bold.
That's right.
And that's a whole other ballgame of art, uh-huh, before the colors, and we don't usually get to see that. So these artist editions are letting us see behind the curtain, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, those are coming out, though, in 2024. IDW also said that they're going to be announcing more DC titles in the coming months. So
nice.
Yeah, these artist editions must sell really well if they're constantly adding more and more to them.
That's so exciting. I can't wait to see what they do next.
Yeah.
Maybe a Kirby. There's got to be a Kirby collection, right?
I don't think he has an artist edition. He might.
No, I mean, like, they've got to do it at some point. Like, oh, I'd love to get a New Gods or even a Jimmy Olsen collection or something like that.
I want to know, like, how do they even get access to these pages? Because, you know, especially modern artists, though, like, they're selling this stuff. Like, Neil Adams must have sold a lot of the pages that are, mm-hmm, going to be in that book. But, yeah, anyway. Also, new news. Captain America is getting a new creative team.
That's right.
With a guy you may have heard of. J. Michael Straczynski, yeah, and Jesus Saez are going to be kicking off a new Captain America series this September. And I put the wrong link.
So yeah, I was trying to find it. I'm looking for it.
I put the link that I linked to in the article. There, I got it.
Swag.
And it's in.
Sweet. Thank you.
Jesus Saez is an incredible artist. He,
yeah,
kind of made waves with Mark Waid on Doctor Strange for a period there. Mm-hmm. And they've, of course, been working on Punisher for a year now, so, and they're on to something new.
Worked on a fairly controversial Captain America run as well.
That's true, yes, Secret Empire, mm-hmm, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah, so it's interesting. So Straczynski's, this isn't his first time working with Captain America either.
Of course, yeah.
So we've got these two powerhouses that have worked on some iconic
and some Cap runs. And some less iconic. And I love... I'm excited about this news. Like you said, Saez is a great artist. I'm a fan of Straczynski. I know that he's had some missteps for sure, especially his DC work, I would say, has been less well received. But I'll always have a lot of love for his writing and his sort of viewpoint on storytelling, because I grew up not only reading his Spider-Man, but also watching Babylon 5. So like,
right. Yeah. So, I've never gotten into that, but I need to.
I don't know that it's possible to do that in the year of our Lord 2023, but
yeah,
it's worth a shot. Yeah, I'm excited. And apparently there's also going to be some kind of other event miniseries that Straczynski is writing.
Yeah, he was, he told IO9 that, you know, he basically was pitched an idea to do a short in one of the anthology, like, Celebration mm-hmm. issues a couple months ago. Then he did another one. And then editor Will Moss was like, well, why don't you do this event?
Mm-hmm.
So, like, he was just taking on these small projects. And then he was like, wait, maybe you have a pitch for Captain America? So that's how this kind of started.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I love that's how it all came together, where they were just like, well, okay, this is clearly... this is our guy. He had a strong enough take that it like changed whatever plans they originally had.
Right, right, right. I know a lot of fans are upset that, you know, Colin Kelly and Jackson Lansing are sure. off.
Great
Captain
run.
America. Yeah, excellent. Excellent run. And they're going to be back for mm-hmm. Captain America 750, the milestone issues coming up. And also joining them is Gail Simone, mm-hmm. Dan Jurgens, Stephanie Williams, Cody Ziegler, R.B. Yeah. Silva, Danielle Acuna, Rachel Stott. It's insane.
Do you
all
think
these creators.
Cody's gonna do a Captain Anarchy story, or do you think it'll Ooh. Like that's what I thought immediately when I saw that.
That'd be cool.
Yeah.
I would love that. Yeah, they're all doing like shorts. Gail actually posted a page, from her story with Danielle Acuna, and Acuna mm-hmm. is so good.
Yeah, yeah, she was like, and you can tell like she was stoked to have him on this story because she keeps mm-hmm. talking. She's just singing his praises on Twitter.
Yeah, I mean the dude is—it's like a painting.
Yeah,
yeah, it should belong in a museum.
Right.
But yeah, so it's an exercise. Issue's coming out July 5th. Oh, it's almost hit July 4th. So close.
So close to the birth of our country.
Yes. But the timing had to have been on purpose, right? Like,
oh, for sure. Yeah.
With the two Cap books running, I think they were like, they're all thinking about like these biweekly shipments and mm-hmm. like when are we going to reach these milestones mm-hmm. that they hit it at a right time of year for maximum profits.
Right. I mean, I guarantee you if there was like a national Bat Day, you know, we'd get a Batman special on that day every year, right?
Mm-hmm. Probably. I think isn't there a Batman Day? I think there
there's got to be a Batman Day, of course. Well, every day's Batman Day in my house.
Only in your house, though.
That's right.
That explains the streamers.
Mm-hmm.
Also, in
speaking
the news,
of the Dark Knight, Night's End.
It's ending. Yeah. I guess Moon Knight number 25, which is this big milestone issue uh-huh. that Marvel's been teasing for a few weeks, we've talked about on this show, is the beginning of the end. Knight's End is the story arc. Jed McKay is, I guess, exiting the book.
Jed,
they didn't actually say this.
The sneaky
that he's exiting,
cuss.
But...
we had him on the show just a few weeks ago
yes,
talking about
yes.
how do you juggle all these books.
Yes.
And he knew Knight's yes. End was approaching.
He did. He didn't even mention it.
Mm-mm.
A jerk. No. The press release that was sent to me doesn't say he's done.
Right.
But then I saw comicbook.com say he is. So
on Twitter, he's playing very coy about it.
Yeah.
I wouldn't be surprised if this like morphs into a new kind of series. Mm-hmm. But we'll see. I mean, I don't know. I can't imagine they're going to... I feel like this book is still doing really well.
Yeah.
So I can't imagine they're going to just end it, but I guess we'll find out soon.
I mean, the truth is, and we talked about this with Jed a little bit, like, mm-hmm. it's really hard to get your book up to this many issues.
Yes, yeah.
I saw Steve Orlando tweeting about how he'll be lucky if he can get Scarlet Witch to 10.
Yeah.
And when we talked to him a few weeks ago,
yeah.
I think he definitely confirmed that he's getting to 10, but yeah.
Yeah.
Beyond that, like the sales just kind of slowly dropped because people, that excitement of a new series
right.
is gone.
Well, and then it's also, yeah, the Marvel tries to, I mean, a lot of publishers now try to do things on a sort of hype basis, you know, like you got to make sure that the audience continues to be there.
Right.
And so,
right.
so it's always a little scary to green light something for an ongoing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and we talked a little bit about this last week with Leah Williams and Joanne Starr, where, you know, hopefully, you know, Power Girl and Fire and Ice will, you know, hit with audiences and we'll get more than, you know, the initial planned issues. And
right.
But, you know, you never know for sure.
Right. And we keep saying this too, like mm-hmm. Poison Ivy number 13 is coming out next week
mm-hmm.
and it's because of the sales.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Originally a six issue, seven issue miniseries.
Six issue.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Crazy. Mm-hmm. Love it.
What do you suppose the fascination of the big two is with Knight, K-N-I-H, GHT.
I mean, I think it's just like a classic heroic archetype.
I see it all the time, like, you know, Dark Knight, death metal, and mm-hmm. I think, was that Night? I don't know.
That was N-I-G-H-T-S, yeah.
Yeah, crazy. Crazy kids. Also a bunch of crazy kids. Mm. Ed Brubaker and Sean Phillips, probably the hardest working people in comics.
Yeah, they're up there for sure.
They announced their next graphic novel, Where the Body Was, coming mm-hmm. out in December. Literally, I think a week or 10 days before their next graphic novel's mm-hmm. even out.
And this story, this tells a story that takes place over the course of decades.
Amazing.
And Brubaker says, inspired by a bunch of wild things that happened when I was a teenager in Southern California, from small crimes to a murder plot. Wow. And it all takes place in one neighborhood. I love it. I think that's
so fun. It
comes with
a map. I love that.
It comes with a map. He says it's like a diorama of crime. So I'm fascinated by this. Anytime these two get together, it results mm-hmm. in at least one of my favorite books of the year. Mm-hmm. I think Pulp was my favorite book of the year a couple years ago.
Pulp was so good. Yep.
It's at least, yeah, definitely up there, one of my favorites of the last 5 years. And this looks already, I'm already excited to have this, you know, steal my heart in a couple months.
I think it was about a year ago they announced, like, these two are going to be coming out with two graphic novels a year.
Good.
For
forever.
Like 3 or 4 years. Yeah, it's crazy. It would be funny if, like, randomly, like, the next one is just, like, an alien mm-hmm. book. There's no crime.
Oh, also, Jacob Phillips, That Texas Blood, will be doing colors on this mm-hmm. book, so even more exciting.
It's pretty cool. From Dark Horse, the complete North mythology is coming in November. This is collecting the three trade paperbacks into a massive, oversized mm-hmm. hardcover edition. If you're not familiar with Norse mythology, it's an adaptation of Neil Gaiman's book. Mm-hmm. That's an adaptation of North mythology.
Yeah, where he essentially tries to, he sort of streamlines it, but also tells yep. the full stories, and each story has unbelievable rotating team of artists, including a lot of his regular collaborators like Colleen Doran and Mike Mignola, Gabriel Walta. Like, there's some real, and Mark Buckingham. It's a fantastic series. If you haven't read it yet, this is like the perfect opportunity to get the whole thing at once.
I saw some fan like, nice, Dark Horse. I just bought the third volume and now this comes out. Like, you're really screwing over fans.
Or just like, relax, because you have the whole thing. It's cool. Like, you don't have to double dip. Like,
do you know how this works? Like,
yeah,
this happens all the time. You know, one of these days, one of these fans that I call out on the show is going to find me. You were talking about me on your podcast.
I have a particular set of skills.
Oh, God. P. Craig Russell is the one who's adapting, and mm-hmm. he also draws a bunch of these. If you don't know Craig, he did a lot of the Conan stories with Dark Horse for a while. Yeah. So, like, this is his, like, wheelhouse right here.
Oh, for sure. And I love his Conan stories.
Mm-hmm. The slipcase is gorgeously done by David Mack, too.
Yeah.
And in our last bit of news, Webtoons announced these three-episode series mm-hmm. Called Love Stories, mm-hmm. which celebrate LGBTQ+ people?
Romances, yeah.
Romances, yeah. And the hook of it, though...
They're inspired by songs from pop stars.
And there's a different artist on each one. Mm-hmm. Yeah, this kind of came out of nowhere, but Webtoon is constantly like kind mm-hmm. of trying things out, which is cool.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know, I also love that they've, you know, they've gotten some pretty big names, Hayley Kiyoko, Ava Max, and folks who were just like very positive and excited for this project.
Yeah,
and I if this helps people feel seen and also brings more attention to the Webtoon model, and Webtoon is able to put some more good into the world, I think this is a win all around.
I'm familiar with all of these pop stars. You've heard of them?
Uh-huh.
Oh, okay. I'm just so outside of the music.
It's okay.
Scene.
I just like pop music.
That's funny. Moving on to our next segment, we're going to talk about our top two comics out this week.
Yeah.
What was your second favorite book of the week?
I really enjoyed Power Girl Special, number one by Leah Williams, Joanne Starr, Natasha Bustos, and Marguerite Sauvage. I always say Sauvage. I don't know if that's actually accurate, but it sounds cool, right?
It does.
Either way, Marguerite, amazing, incredible artist. Yep. We talked a lot about this book last week, so I won't keep you guys too long, but I loved this story that is ostensibly a, you know, Power Girl saving the world from Johnny Sorrow, mm. who is... sort of tearing everything apart by manipulating people's emotions and creating these sort of emotionally powered monsters. But more than that, it's a story about Paige kind of coming to grips with her own insecurities and her self-defeating prophecies, and learning to love herself and take her place among the Superman family, which I think is beyond past time for that. I just really loved this story. I also love the backup with Fire and Ice, which leads directly into their new series of, you know, just showing sort of these two characters who are so diametrically opposed from an emotional standpoint, who need each other and love each other, and they're a family unit. They bicker like a family, and Ice in particular sort of coming to grips with like how do I define myself? How do I move forward with my life, knowing that I've literally died and come back and having to sort of pick myself up, and, you know, am I allowed to become a new person? I mean, these are all kind of questions that are playing out in the periphery, and both stories are just absolutely gorgeously illustrated. I think it's a great special, and it has me excited for both of the ongoings that are coming out of this.
There's a lot of great emotionality in both stories, mm-hmm. really, and like I think the Power Girl story kind of closes the door on the backup stories that we're building to it.
Mm-hmm.
So that we're like ready for a new start.
Definitely.
Number one issue in September.
Both stories really feel like, okay, here we are now.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I can't wait to see Fire and Ice in Smallville. That should be interesting.
It's going
to
be a good time. Especially like Joanne telling us that Martha Kent is like a major character in the book has me so happy.
Yeah. That'll be cool. It's an interesting dynamic to play with.
For sure. What'd you like this week?
I really like Clobber in Time, which I keep talking about on this show.
Oh, yeah, it's great.
The third issue by Steve Scrooge. This book is so fascinating to me. Like, Scrooge is drawing and writing, of course, mm-hmm. and there's like an adult vibe to it when it comes to, like, I don't know, violence and seeing things butt at the end of the issue.
Dude, this book, like, legitimately has some body horror stuff that like really surprises me every month. Like there's always at least something about seeing Thing bleeding with like gashes in his arm. Really, right. I'm like, that's not right. Right.
Yeah. It's like the rock is just the top layer of his skin just ripped off.
Yeah.
Yeah, and he goes so for it. This one features Dr. Strange. Uh-huh. This book's basically been a team-up book with a ongoing underlying story,
mm-hmm.
Which you get a lot more information on this issue because we get a lot of backstory on the villain that's been popping up.
Yes.
It's just super fun. It's in-your-face punching and stuff. Mm-hmm. The book opens at a restaurant with Aunt Petunia.
Yes.
And I love, like, Dr. Strange comes in like a train,
mm-hmm.
but it's a dragon that's, like, chasing him. Like,
right.
Someone must have got hurt when that happened. But apparently no one did.
It's a hell of an entrance.
It is, really. So, yeah, it's just visually stunning mm-hmm. book, and it's you're guaranteed to have some fun with it every time.
Definitely. I loved it.
And then our favorite book of the week was DC Pride.
Yeah.
Surprise, surprise.
This is their latest, this is the third, correct? Their annual anthologies with just powerhouse creative teams. Grant Morrison, Leah Williams, A.L. Kaplan, Josh Trujillo, Christopher Cantwell, Skylar Patridge, like telling some really great stories, short stories about DC's queer characters. Many of these being very quiet and personal tales, not a whole lot of big, aside from, you know, a couple of these stories, not a whole lot of big, like, cosmic, you know, earth-shaking moments. In fact, like, one of my favorites of the bunch is just Tim Drake and Connor Hawke having a conversation about coming out to their parents.
Right, right. Yeah, and Connor's like, I haven't even told my dad who, like, I'm a superhero.
Right, right.
On top of everything else, yeah. And you're right, it's over 100 pages. It's curated so well, too, mm-hmm. right? Like, there isn't a ton of repeat characters mm-hmm. at all. I think that's happened before. And then the pinups in between stories are really beautifully done, too.
Yeah, absolutely. There's some really great ones. Babs Tarr does a Harley and Ivy one. Maria Lovett does a gorgeous Doom Patrol pinup. Noah Dow does a great poke, one of a bunch of characters playing poker, which I was just very excited because I'm like, oh my gosh, it's Mikhail Thomas, Extraño, like all these characters that I'm like, why don't you all hang out all the time? This is awesome.
What's the deal with all the mice in that one?
Pied Piper.
Of course. Catman and Ghostmaker have a little romp on a roof. And then the romp goes to their bedroom.
That's right. No, it's a fun time. And there's also some really great essays in here. There's one at the top by Phil Jimenez. There's several creators paying tribute to Rachel Pollack, who passed away earlier this year. Leah Williams, I think, has my favorite story of the bunch. Her Harley, Ivy, and Crush just kind of having a conversation about the nature of love and how you can find somebody that's so diametrically, like, so different from you who makes you whole.
Right.
And I love that so much. And I was also a big fan of the Midnighter and Apollo and Alan Scott story, which has some of the Donna Guillo's artwork in the story is just gorgeous.
There's some great messaging throughout that just feel like some people out there need to hear it to feel better about themselves and the life they're living and give them hope.
Positioning characters that have been around for a long time as survivors, right? Like, Alan Scott, a character who has really only been out in the comics for a couple of years, but is saying like, look, I've been in the closet for, 40 years or whatever.
Right,
I've lived through the AIDS crisis. I've lived through all of these things. And we just have to, keep talking. We have to be better than them. And we have to keep fighting and finding, and it is, I think that story really synthesizes something that I've been feeling for so long, where I'm so fucking angry all the time about the legislation that's being passed in this country and just some of the hate and ignorance and the trajectory that we're on as a country, and seeing a character say like, I'm still here. We have to be better. We can't stop pushing, right?
Right.
And seeing, a character like Midnighter, who his first reaction is always, I'm going to rip their fucking head off, realizing that, like, he and Alan aren't really, they're not fighting a different fight just because they're fighting it differently. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like, it's all, anything you can do for your fellow man is important. It's a really great, really, really, really strong anthology.
Right. The messaging of like, we're here, we're alive, we're going to stay and not be quiet is, I think, really important. Like, we exist, I think, is kind of a message underlying everything. And
it's a lot of wish fulfillment too. Like, I wish I could take over every fucking screen on the planet.
Which happens in the Apollo Midnighter story.
So great.
It's great to see the rage of the people watching from whatever state they're in. So very angry. Yeah. It's important for a book like this to exist and for these characters to exist. And I think a lot of these stories make interesting points about that.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
man. So yeah, DC just continues to kill it on this. I think Marvel's Pride issue is coming out in a week or two from now.
Yeah.
We'll see how it stacks up. It's hard not to compare them because they're kind of the same model, an anthology of superheroes that don't get enough play getting their own stories.
Yeah.
Well, that's it for Top Books of the Week. In our next segment, Standout.
Kapow.
Moment of the Week. We talk about our favorite panel or page came out this week. Mm-hmm. What was your favorite panel or page?
I went a little differently this week, and I would just like to recommend that everybody read Phil Jimenez's foreword to DC Pride 2023, in which he basically discusses what being queer in a superhero universe actually means. How does what does that even mean in this genre where everything is larger than life, where everyone is constantly fighting for justice? Are there, would there even be, anti-gay and anti-trans legislation in a world where the JSA exists and is always trying to make people be the best versions of themselves?
Right.
And it's a really, really lovely bit of work. Also, just talking about his own experiences being gay in the comics industry and how, you know, he talks about, you know, he was the first publicly out mainstream superhero artist, hardly the first out artist in the business. But, yeah. You know, he says that at one point. And he says, but I would not have the life I do now if it wasn't for DC Comics. And I love the experiences I've had because I'm gay. I love the people I've met. I love seeing the world through the strange kaleidoscopic lens of queer otherness. And sort of just talking about how this anthology is, you know, is meant to, not meant to necessarily preach to people, but to invite them into joy, to be able to, you know, leave the box that you may find yourself in behind and love who you want to love and believe in justice for all and to fight like hell for it, which is a quote from this piece. It really hit me yesterday. And he talks about working with Kelly Sue DeConnick on Wonder Woman Historia, a book that is, quote, queer and feminist to the bone, both explicitly and implicitly. And I love it. I love it so much. And I think it's a really important read. So if you're going to pick this book up, because we've, sung its praises to the rafters. Please don't skip the foreword. It's really lovely.
Yeah, there's a lot of great messaging in there, just about his identity, too, mm-hmm. and how he's professionally gay.
It's a great, great quote, yeah.
Yeah, it's important, and we're going to have to continue to, you know, make these statements and mm-hmm. put out books like this, mm-hmm. because obviously queer people are under attack mm-hmm. more than ever, mm-hmm. which is so frightening. Mm-hmm. God, it felt like 10 years ago we were in a much better place in this country, and it seems to only get worse as the years go on.
Yeah.
But it's a really powerful opening for sure.
And yeah, I don't normally go for specifically text in my kapow moment, but I don't know that anything really hit me that hard this week. It's really lovely.
It hit you metaphorically.
It did. It kapowed me in the heart.
Yeah, we should rename the segment to Kapow Me in the Heart. Oh my god, that could be a really good song.
Kapow Me in my heart.
There you go. Oh my god, you did like an NSYNC thing.
No, I was doing Tell It to My Heart.
Oh, okay. Nice.
Taylor Dane? No, not Taylor. Yeah. Yeah? Is that the name? I don't know. Anyway, what was your kapow moment?
I really liked the moment in Detective Comics number 1072 by Ron V and Ivan Reis and Stefano Raffaelli. There's a moment where Batman is facing off against these threats that he's already faced before and lost, or been beaten down pretty badly by them. And it's a double page layout where we get to see at the top panel. And again, if you go to aptcomics.com and go to the podcast post, you can see this art in full.
Mm-hmm.
He's facing off against a werewolf man and a man with six arms.
Yeah, the Ten Claw and the Flesh Crafter.
Yeah, and then there are six panels at the center of this layout, which show like very specific moves, like him throwing his batarangs, the batarangs hitting the wolfman.
It's tipped with silver.
Yeah, and the captions kind of detail how this isn't just a fight like with fists. This is a tactical mm-hmm. Moment because he's learned their weaknesses, and he will never, if you defeat Batman once, you're never going to defeat him again because now he knows how to defeat you back. So it's just a badass moment. It's drawn really well. I love how it breaks down the fight in the way it does. It's very so symmetrical.
Good. Yeah.
Yeah. So like, it's a profound moment in the arc because mm-hmm. these are two mega threats, and it's not like he just punches one in the face and it's over. Like it really gives those villains a moment to be like, okay, no way. Actually, they are difficult to beat, but unfortunately they're fighting Batman. That was my kapow.
And in an arc, like in a series that's not like really heavy on action, like Detective Rom has been like very specific about, you know, bringing the detective back to Detective Comics. And so mm-hmm. when we get these like bursts of action, it's still done in the service of story and of him being this analytical mind. We also happen to get to see him stab a werewolf with silver and inject another guy with blood thinners that makes his arms melt.
Hate when that happens.
It rules.
There should be more werewolves in comics. Like, why aren't there?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, hopefully Straczynski brings back Wolf Cap.
Yes. One of the coolest ideas that never really has been, like, maximized, no, I don't think.
No, like, guys, I'm not even being facetious. Go read, what was that? Was that Jerry Conway that did Werewolf Captain America?
That sounds right.
But yeah, it fucking rules.
Yeah, it's awesome. Moving on to our top books for next week, mm-hmm. our most anticipated comics out next week. I can't wait for Loki number one by Dan Waters and Jermaine Peralta. Been anticipating this since it was announced. Dan Waters is one of the best writers out there. Mm-hmm. Actually, Dan Waters wrote an amazing backup in Detective Comics 1072, which I didn't even talk about. That is just like, it's like a great myth fable like story. Uh-huh. It's like so well crafted about a little boy in a tree. So I think Dan gets storytelling mm-hmm. in that way. Yeah. And for a character like Loki, who is the god of stories mm-hmm. and lying, I think that could be really impactful and cool. And yeah, it's that's why it's my most anticipated book of the week.
Definitely. I'd also like to recommend, if you like Dan Waters writing about princes of lies, you should check out his Lucifer run from a few years back, mm-hmm. which was mm-hmm. pretty stellar.
For sure.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to New Talent Showcase, Milestone Initiative number one, which is a new anthology edited by Marcus Draper. Basically it showcases a number of new, 24 creators, 12 writers, 12 artists who participated in a 10-week long training program sponsored by Milestone and DC Comics to try to find the next generation of great creators. And so these creators are playing around with short stories in the Milestone universe, including, you know, a Static Shock story, Hardware, stuff like that. Really excited. I love everything Milestone's been doing. We don't have a whole lot of information on all of the creators involved at the moment, but Reginald Hudlin has provided like a really great forward that sort of introduces the whole concept, which you can see on aaptcomics.com. There was one other thing I was going to say about it, and my brain stopped.
You love Milestone.
Oh, I love Milestone, but also my understanding is that this anthology is like 96 pages long and is essentially the cost of a regular book.
Oh, shit.
I believe so. I saw that online. Cool, so, you know, it's got to be true.
It's the internet.
But, you know, I believe it because Milestone also has been doing those huge omnibus editions that are like 1,400 pages and cost insane. $30. So, like, they're really doing the Lord's work in trying to introduce readers to this vast universe in cost-effective mm-hmm. ways. And I think that is so fucking cool. Can't wait to see what these new creators do with some of my favorite characters.
In our next segment, judging by the cover, Junior. I gotta sing it every time. We talk about our favorite cover art out next week. Flash mm-hmm. number 800 has like a billion covers. But my favorite is Michael Cho's, which is so iconic. There's three different Flashes running right at mm-hmm. us. And I just love the what's the word I want? I love the volume that is kind of visible by the logo on Flash's chest, the shading on his mm-hmm. face. Like, you can see the logo on his chest, like, popping out. Cho's art is just, like, it's got this, it's a mastery of simplicity, but, like, perfection at the same time. Like,
it feels timeless.
Yeah. And then, like, you know, there's not a lot of detail to his actual suit, but then you look at his gloves and mm-hmm. there was extra effort put into like the seam along the side, making it look realistic looking. We've got the classic Flash in the back. We've got Barry and Wally in the front and for in the middle ground. It just brings mm-hmm. a smile to your face to see how happy they are running. And you know, running isn't fun, guys. So these guys are really good actors too. No, I'm just kidding.
Absolutely.
What was your favorite cover out next week?
I really love the cover to Groot number 2 by Hernanda Souza. Look, it's Pride Month, y'all. Like, I went for the cover with the most purples and pinks and blues possible. I love it so much. But it's a little baby Groot wearing, which I didn't notice this until like the fifth time I looked at it, but wearing yes. little board shorts and riding on the back of a little yeah. alien fish, and just this beautiful glow to the scenery. The use of color here is exquisite. And the look of happiness on his face, just really, I'm like, my face hurts. I'm grinning ear to ear, like just looking at this right now. Just a fantastic cover. It makes me very excited to check this out. I feel like this was delayed a little bit, right? Like I feel like Groot number one came out a few months ago.
Yeah, a while ago now, yeah. April maybe?
So it's been like I'm 2 months. Yeah. I'm excited to pick back up with this cute little guy.
I love how he has goggles, but he's a root. So wouldn't like water be a good, like, why would he need his eyes protected? Anyway.
I don't know. It's so really cute, great though. He's just chilling. It's a beach day.
It really is. Have the time of his life. Like we are on the show. In our last segment, Tom King and Phil Hester join the show to talk about Gotham Year One. We talk about how this prequel to Batman leads into Batman. Mm-hmm. There's some interesting like seeding of things like Crime Alley, why it's called Crime Alley. We get into why they went that way and how. And
And how Batman begins.
There you go. I just interviewed Ted Adams about his The Great Gatsby comic adaptation.
Awesome.
And it's interesting, like, because I think because I had that on my mind, and then I was reading Gotham Year One, the finale, I was like getting connections between that and The Great Gatsby.
I love The Great Gatsby. I have my favorite books of all time over my shoulder, and there it is on my, you know, whatever top 20 books. I stare at it every single day. Yeah, I love that book. So.
Some of the stuff about like where a body is buried, and like the seediness that's underneath, that symbolic of evil that grows into the Gotham that we know, stuff like that is really interesting and complex.
I mean, thanks. I think I grew up on complex comics, you know, Watchmen, what Frank Miller did, what Alan Moore did, Mouse, all that. I'm of that generation. That's sort of our goal is to declare, I think what all comic fans know, and that I think is doubted too often, is that this is a medium that can express complicated emotions and complicated moral situations. And it can be as powerful as any other medium. Mm. You know, I think from outside people think we're just good guys versus bad guys, and that's all right. It is. But that's not what we are. That's if you're on the inside, you know, it's a constant struggle to push forward and sort of assert that, you know, anything you can do with a book or a movie or a TV show, you can do with a comic.
I've been reviewing most of the series and Danger Street, and Danger Street is like another level of capturing humanity and choices and how we think and feel, or how humanity does. And then in this, it's a little more edged with noir. It's the detective. It's the hard-boiled story. And as someone who studied film noir, as it actually was my master's paper. I went to school for screenwriting, and that was like our master's class. Are you a fan of film noir? And are there any favorites of yours, be it film or hard-boiled detective novels?
I'm a huge fan of film noir. It's kind of where I live when I'm not living in comics. That's like my nerd.
Nice.
I want to say like 3 years ago, I'm a big old movie. I'm a TCM guy. I'm an old movie fan. That's how I relax. I'm not watching comics. I watch old movies. Yeah. I steal from them constantly. I mean, just, you know, the True Grit for Supergirl. Mm. Although that's more stolen from the book. But about 3 years ago, I went out to dinner with Michael Cronenberg, who's a designer for comic magazines, and he introduced me to Eddie Muller, who runs TCM sort of noir alley. Cool. And is the most knowledgeable noir person probably in the world. And Michael and Eddie started talking, and they were talking in this sort of noir language about books and movies. And I had seen the basics, you know, whatever, the top 10, but I hadn't sort of dug into the dirtiness of it all. And I was like, I want to learn this language. There's something in here that I was like, I need to, like, this will help me as a storyteller. And like, you have your instinct. And I literally took a year where I just, every chance I could get, I was watching an old noir. And I knew Ed Brubaker had kind of gone down this alley and had, you know, hits. And I was like, I want to figure this out. I want to know, you know, the difference between an Evelyn Keyes and an Audrey Totter, you know, like that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, that's what I did. And it's been valuable in my work and valuable in my relaxation. And it's just, yeah, I mean, I was watching The Maltese Falcon in the middle of the night last night when I couldn't sleep.
Classic.
So it's good. It's still what I do. Yeah.
It's interesting too. With a detective story like this, Gotham Year One, like there's so many different places you could have started before you started tangling it all together. Because this final issue really does entangle almost everything. I say almost everything. Maybe it is everything. Where did you get the start? Was there a certain character you fixated on or a moment in this story arc?
Well, I mean, I had done deconstructions of noir sort of with you know, what Human Target was, which was, you know, more of a fun kind of, you know, it was more of the Dick Powell kind of making fun of noir, you know, from Murder, My Sweet. For this one, when we sort of approached it, I was like, I want to just drink from the fire hose. Like, not a deconstruction, but like actual hard-boiled Chinatown noir. Hmm. Just, you know, the straight Dashiell Hammett, you know, Ray Chandler, right down the middle kind of noir, which, you know, there's a formula to that. There's Private Eye works in a dirty city and a beautiful woman walks in and the world and lies to them. And those lies lead him to uncover a huge conspiracy. That's the formula of Private Eye. Now, noir is a much, I think Eddie has the best definition of noir. Noir is when you're following a bad guy trying to make, a good man making bad decisions while trying to make good decisions. It's following the mistakes, which I think is the right look at it. So it's a very complicated genre that has, you know, heist movies and it encompasses a lot. But that one corner, that sort of Private Eye corner, the corner that John Huston's making fun of in The Big Sleep almost, is where I wanted to start. So I started with that, with a beautiful young woman walking into a private eye and then his partner being killed, as happens in The Maltese Falcon. And then I needed a big crime. So I started reading a lot of true crime books, looking sort of for the right thing. And I mean, it's terribly obvious that I went with the Lindbergh kidnapping.
Right.
And I got totally obsessed with that, where I could tell you like every little detail of every Lindbergh. Like, and so I put that on top of that noir. And then I added Gotham City. So it was those three elements. It was Maltese Falcon, Lindbergh kidnapping, Gotham City, combining into one sort of thing. And then I started right there.
It's interesting. I can imagine a lot of, you know, Batman or Gotham or DC Comics fans reading this and getting interested in noir because of exactly what you're kind of saying. You're layering all these different kind of influences and making something new. At the same time, though, reading this, I kept thinking, like, the connections to Gotham and, like, say, how Crime Alley got its name are really interesting. But at the same time, this story could probably stand alone without being a DC Comics title. Did part of you ever think, oh, this could be, you know, an indie, you know, noir that I do on the side or from a different publisher? Or did it always have to be part of the Gotham narrative?
I mean, it was the assignment from the beginning was, Tom, tell me a Batman story without using Batman. Ah. Use the first 26 issues of Detective Comics to tell me a story. Mm-hmm. That was the challenge from Ben Abernathy, my editor.
Nice.
So it was always a Gotham story. So I never thought, oh, I should do this as an indie. Mostly what I thought is they're never going to let me do this again. And I should just enjoy the fuck out of this, lack of a better phrase. Yeah. Because I was like, there's no superhero. This is a DC comic. Mm-hmm. It's getting all the push of a DC comic. I get all the wonderful benefits of being a DC comic. But there's no superheroes. Nobody has a power. There's violence. There's punching. But there's not that much punching. The point of the thing isn't the punching. And so to me, it's like just a completely unique opportunity that I know doesn't come around. I mean, I've almost been writing comics for 10 years. You don't get these every day.
Right.
You know, I'm writing Wonder Woman, which I very much enjoy, but it's superheroes. It's people punching each other.
Right.
That's an expectation. Part of the assignment.
Yeah.
Yeah. I've written 100 issues of Batman. There's not one issue where I thought, okay, in this issue, there's no superpowers, no punching, and it's all psychological thriller. There was that was not a thing.
Yeah.
So that was almost a gift. It was like DC was basically, you know, it's probably like when, I mean, I'm not comparing myself to Tarantino, but like when Tarantino got Pulp Fiction, he's like, I have studio money to make an indie thing.
Right.
That's what I felt like. I feel like I was nice. Had studio money to make an indie project.
That makes sense. And it was probably exciting to get that assignment too, do a Gotham story without Batman.
It was exciting until I opened up those first 26 issues of Detective, which if you've read them, you know, you're like, oh, there's going to be some beautiful gems in here. There's some, you know, I'm always at the point that you can turn anything into anything, you know, I mean, I think that's what Danger Street is. Like, Lady Cop can be a serious character, a serious modern character, mm-hmm. which she seems, you know, utterly laughable on the surface, but you can dig in and find cool things. But those first, I was like, oh, this is a desert. This is just full of, it's like super colonialist kind of, you know, narratives of, you know, adventurers going into foreign lands and, mm-hmm. and beating up on people they shouldn't beat up on.
Right, right.
And I was like, what, how do I extract from this something that is modern? And you know, that's, I mean, all of it was just so dated. And so that's how I hit on Sam Bradley.
Nice.
And modernized. I was like, because Sam was in the first one, he's created by, you know, the same people who created Superman. And his first episode is very, I don't think there's a better way to put it, but it's racist. It's anti-Asian. And so I was also, I was like, oh, I'm gonna make race part of this rather than sort of ignore that. And that's how that kind of entered the equation.
Right. I was explaining the plot of this story to some friends the other day, and they were like, wow, that's so interesting that DC's like allowing a story about race in this way too, but also it being the kind of origin. It's like the start of, I love the concept of Gotham is the safest city in the world, unless you're black, which I think you introduce in issue 2 or 3, or maybe it's the first issue, which I thought was so smart of you because like it makes you start to think about race today, even though it is set, and I think, was it the 60s, I think, when we started?
Yeah, it's set in 1961. Yeah, that's where we are, yeah.
Watch Ben this weekend's like, hey, I have an idea. Let's do a Batman story, but he does his taxes.
I can see that. I'm in. Yeah, I mean, I grew up in Los Angeles. I was 11 years old when the LA riots happened,
yeah.
12 years old. Mm-hmm. And my school was set afire, and you know, I saw a city sort of torn apart by race, and how that sort of revealed. Like when I was little, you know, LA was supposed to be this sort of beautiful paradise. You know, we were supposed to think of LA as like, you know, Beverly Hills. As LA was the Hollywood dream.
Right.
It's where everyone in the country wanted to get off the bus, and then like. I mean, people, I mean, you go back, I mean, I was 11, so I didn't know, you know, but sure. Like, so it was eye-opening for me, but not for the whole city, but like, there was actually like underneath that sort of beauty that everyone's projecting on us, there was segregation and exploitation. And eventually that exploded into these riots. And to me, that felt just from a personal point of view, like the death or the waking up from a dream of a city, not the death of it, but just me personally waking up. Mm-hmm. And so I wanted to project some of that into this book.
Phil, I think you're here. It looks like you might be frozen.
Hello.
Oh, you can hear us though.
Phil, I've been talking too much. Thank God you're here. We need some Midwestern modesty.
We've been talking about noir quite a bit. And something that struck me in the final issue is, you know, the town, the city is on fire, which is such a common, or not common, it's such a key feature of noir, this nihilism, this the world is ending, which I think you nailed. And there's so many different aspects mm-hmm. of noir that's nailed in this, including, Phil, the silhouettes. The use of silhouette in this book is freaking insane. I just wanted to ask, like, what went into picking the opportune time to use silhouette? Because you do it in different ways, of course, with the colors making it even more striking at times, too.
I wanted to make a conscious effort to, I mean, I've always had sort of a shadow drenched style. And I wanted to make a conscious effort in this book to also play with negative space silhouettes. And find a way to, I don't know if anyone will ever pick up on this. I might be the only person who ever notices it, but I think the theme of the book is how actions reverberate through time, positive and negative. And so I thought I could bolster that by repeating compositions from panel to panel and page to page at different points in the book. And not necessarily repeating the actual setup of the panel, mm-hmm. but repeating the actual composition with different elements. Mm-hmm. And silhouettes became an important part of that because they were a good shorthand for dropping in a different compositional element. So became a main weapon in my arsenal throughout the whole book.
It's a strong weapon, let me tell you. It's very striking, and it comes at the most opportune times. Tom, were you ever writing it in, like, do a cool silhouette here?
No. That's impressive. All Phil taking, going above and beyond. I write for artists. I work with a lot of artists who are panel based, who are just, you know, drawing panel by panel, and that's how I write my scripts, because I think it's a lot harder to tell the story the other way. And I've only worked with a few guys who can do it, who can kind of get rid of the panels and do sort of silhouettes and more pages. I did it with Andy Kubert, and now I've done it with Phil. And it's you have to be so good at your craft, just as a guy who's been in this and seen so many trip people. Like, you don't understand the level of skill it takes for an Andy or Phil to pull off that kind of storytelling. And it's breathtaking for a writer to see that happen to a script. You can't write for that. That has to be their vision. It won't work if you write for it, to me.
Sometimes I think of art as like jazz, because, you know, the work Jordi Belair is doing too with the atmosphere, like just the use of color is astounding too. And also, you know, I don't want to leave out Eric Gapster's inks as well. Like, I've actually spoken to him before for the AIPT Comics podcast, and he's so talented too. Phil, what was it like working with them?
Oh, I've been working with Eric for, we noted that it was, I've been working, assignment was a Slam Bradley story. Gotham City represents sort of the 10-year anniversary of working with Eric.
Oh, cool.
And we started, you know, we started working together on a Slam Bradley story for when Batman Legends of the Dark Knight was the digital first book.
Oh, yeah, I remember that.
And we did a little Slam Bradley story there with Josh Fialkov. Yeah, and it was a blast. And our editor was Ben Abernathy, and he's got the memory of an elephant, and he remembered that we had drawn Slam before, and it made it a natural for us to get together again. But since Park sort of semi-retired from inking about 10 years ago, Eric's been my regular guy.
Nice.
And we've always been looking for ways to get together. And since then, and this is our first time working with Jordy, and I have to say Jordy's a genius. I think I have a very hard time proofing my own work because I don't like to look at it once it's done.
Right.
I'm like Adam Driver, you know, I don't want to see the clips of my own work. But when Jordy has colored it, it's a joy to look at it again. Mm. And suddenly she legitimizes all my garbage. So, I think the choices Jordy makes are never they're always surprising, but always appropriate. And I couldn't be happier with the coloring I got from her.
The book is really striking because of all three of you and how well you're working together. It's impressive stuff. Moving on to some elements that you've been kind of putting into the book, Tom. I mentioned this earlier. I don't think it's a big spoiler to say you explain why Crime Alley is named that. Are there other elements like that you wanted to sprinkle into the book? Because I know there's at least one in the finale too that you didn't get to
No, we got the Crime Alley. We got we have Ace Chemicals.
Ace Chemical, yep. Batman, the Bat Cave, the Bat Symbol, I suppose, in a way.
The Bat Cave is there, the Bat Symbol, all those bullet holes in the living room of the manor. We even talked about the tunnel that goes to the Bat Cave. The main thing was to get across how Gotham kind of sank, how it fell,
yeah,
how it went from being any other American city to a city, you know, the home of all sin in the world. And I think we got there. We got what we wanted. How sort of one man and one family sin became the city's, you know, burden.
Yeah, they're always rewarding when you did those little connections, especially for those longtime DC fans who are like, oh, they're doing the DiCaprio point meme at the comic.
It hit me when I was just reading the script to learn to draw it. There was a time that hit me, and it's in the, not to get spoilery, but it's in the flash forward to the 70s.
Mm.
And it's such a subtle moment that it's a kind of a tribute to how well Tom has crafted the story that I didn't see it coming, and it hit me like a ton of bricks. And I'm not going to spoil it because I want people to be rewarded when they find it, but it's the origin of Batman in a little tiny line of dialogue. It's really incredible.
Yeah, it's nuanced. It doesn't feel like, I don't know, what's the word? Forced, I guess? Yeah. So.
And that, yeah, the origin of Batman's in there too. That little thing.
With the final issue out the 28th, might we ever get a sequel, a year two per se?
I would, people are going to have to buy the crap out of the trade, because I would write these forever.
Yeah.
If DC Comics said, do another one, I'd drop one. I mean, I love Wonder Woman, but this was just such a joy, just from being fun to write, like just going to work every day and having a smile on my face. This every bit of this process was, I just loved it. I loved writing that voice. I loved those captions. I love writing those hard-boiled characters, I love writing as if, you know, I'm Ben Hecht in 1940 and I can only use those kind of words instead of our kind of words.
Right.
It was an utter joy. If we get, you know, the Supergirl sort of the beauty of that, where it was like you know, it was a fine book. It sold what it's sold, but nobody was asking for a sequel. But now it's like a huge best-selling graphic novel.
Yeah.
I'm just praying for that to happen again, so I can just keep doing these books for the rest of my life, for sure. I love them.
You definitely seem like one of the most busiest comics writers these days. Tom, I'd be remiss not to ask about Wonder Woman. How long have you known, or how long have you been working on the project?
6 months or something? It's been a while. Yeah, it's been, we've been building this for quite some time. And Daniel Sempor, who's drawing the book, is super fast and super good. So I think by the time it comes out in September, we'll have something like 6 or 7 issues in the can. So,
and then
we are out.
Wow. That's amazing. That's really great. I mean, and Danger Street must be done by now too, because there was a few delays there. So you've got like multiple books just like scripted and sort of getting drawn at the same time.
Well, yeah, I mean, one of the reasons I look like I'm very efficient is because I was very efficient during the pandemic. Oh. My efficiency has actually dropped significantly because of all the Hollywood work. Mm. But during the pandemic, some people did, you know, baked bread. I wrote comics. And so I got so far ahead. Yeah. I mean, I wrote Human Target that just ended. That was written, you know, a year and a half ago. I wrote Danger Street over a year ago. It's completely done. I mean, Jorge has every single script.
Nice.
I mean, I had this wonderful time in my life, which has since ended, where I had gotten so far ahead that I could write my books in order. Mm. I stole this from Brad Meltzer. So Gotham Year One was written, you know, all 6 issues, one after another. And I just kind of wrote it like a novel. I just lived in that world. And it's a much better way to write. And I wish I could go back to it. I'll try to get back to it as soon as I can. I'm super far ahead. There's a whole mini series that's written, is being drawn right now, that will come out at some point, that I wrote a year ago.
That must be
so there's all of these
with things. Looming deadlines kind of crushing a lot of creators. That must be a relief to know you have something in the, you know, in the barrel of the gun, per se, or so to speak.
Yeah, it is. Except when you lose it, like I'm currently losing it. And, you know, cause I was on Double Shit Batman for 5 years, you know, and that was just where you're writing issue 19, and then you're writing issue 35, and then you're writing issue 7, and then you're writing issue, like, whatever. You have to just have to feed the artists, and you just talk to your editor every week, like, who needs pages. So it was so beautiful to be on books where you could sort of take your time and relax into it. But now I just have so much Hollywood work that it's throwing off my wonderful comic book schedule. That's my problem. You guys don't have to worry about it. That's between me and how much time I spend with my children. That's all it is.
I was just interviewing Zeb Wells, and he was saying the same thing with the double shipping of Spider-Man. He's writing like 3 issues ahead, this issue 2, issue 4, issue 7, all at the same time. I don't know how you wrap your head around that kind of thing. Like, I would just forget who said what and when Mary Jane died or whatever.
It's well, you know, right now I'm writing Penguin and Wonder Woman. Mm-hmm. So I'll go from 1 week of writing the most kind and generous DC character to writing the most evil, obnoxious, horrible human being. Like, and you know, they both have dialogue, and I have to remember, okay, this is the nice one, this is the mouse. It's such a bizarre switch between those two characters.
Oh, shoot. I got some Penguin dialogue in my Wonder Woman comic. Damn it.
And it's once you get, once you write one together. Sentence. It's a challenge. Hopefully I can go back to the novel writing stuff. Cause I think I made my writing a little better too. Just from a quality.
Something else I wanted to ask, maybe this is the last question, but like, I've talked to Scott Snyder multiple times, and like, he was telling me, you know, part of the joy of writing comics is it's so fast. You can write the comic and then see it in sometimes 3 months, if not 2 months, whatever, and then see an audience reaction. Are you ever like pining for that, since it sounds like a lot of your projects have been written maybe even years ago at this point?
No, I mean, I agree with Scott. That's the comics are the best, most fun medium to write for, having written novels and now doing the Hollywood stuff. I haven't written video games, so I haven't done that yet, so maybe that's wonderful. But between those three, comics are the most fun, and they're most rewarding. You have the most freedom. And yes, you write a comic, your editor sees it, he thinks it's good or bad, and he sends it on to the artist. And yeah, 3 months later, someone's commenting on it. That's not how it is. To write a novel, that's a 3-year process with 4 bajillion edits. Mm. To write a movie or a TV show, that's, you know, it's an endless, infinite process with a billion people looking on, and then it gets canceled the last second. So like, that's, it's so much more. Writing comics is the joy. But yeah, I don't I don't know. I never sort of, when I'm writing a project where I know it won't be done years from now, I don't know. I'm just, when I'm writing a comic, I'm living the comic. I'm just utterly inside it. And I don't think of it as terms of when it will get published. I just, that week I'm living that comic. And then, you know, a year later, I'll get it back in the letters and I'll be like, oh shit, I was a terrible writer.
Right, right. I could see that. Meanwhile, like, Phil, like as an artist, you're like living in every panel for many, many minutes. So it's like almost like the opposite on some scale. Like you're living in those literal seconds.
As somebody that's sort of written and drawn comics, I've lived on both sides of that. Mm-hmm. And it, ironically, when you're the artist, you wind up living with the story a little bit longer than the writer does, mm-hmm. because you have to actually, you know, translate it and turn it into images. Mm-hmm. So it's not just, I know sometimes when I'm writing and it really feels good and you're just flying along, you're jamming. But when you're an artist, you like live with a page for a couple of days, mm-hmm. and you see things that maybe even the writer doesn't see, or anybody else on the team doesn't see. And then if you see opportunities pop up in that, you know, it's your duty to sort of like, you know, nudge your writer and say, I saw this thing in here. Is this what you intended? Is this what is this something we want to accentuate? And I think that results in cooler comics.
Totally. Yeah. That back and forth. I've been writing a comic with a childhood friend for fun. And I made the mistake of telling him I wrote a script in 2 hours that he spent 6 months drawing. And he got very, very angry. He's also lettering and coloring it, so it's taking a while.
Yeah.
But yeah, I never don't ever tell the artist how fast you wrote the book, I guess, is the lesson I learned.
I recently had to do some covers for DC Comics. And it's a horrible, horrible job you have, Phil. And I'm so glad I'm on this side. Drawing is the worst. I'm sorry.
No, it's a great job. It's the best job in the world.
Sit.
Oh, my God. I make a mistake with my script. I'm like, delete, delete, delete. Go back to previous save draft. I made a mistake on the cover. I was like, I have to tear this whole fucking thing out. Like I'm writing with a typewriter. Oh, I hate this.
I guess if you're an artist working digitally, you can at least command Z. So there's something like that.
Yeah, I draw the worst, worst, worst art in all time. And I was like, damn, I drew that head too big. Now this foot doesn't work. Fuck. And I'm drawing in stick figures. And I'm messing it up.
Yeah, they don't care.
Well, I don't take up any more of your time. Thank you so much for chatting with me. This has been very enlightening and interesting.
Thank you for covering this little book that I adore. I hope it gets out there. I hope people see it. Thank you. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for having us.